You are listening to a Bible talk recorded at the 2014 Western Christadelphian Bible School at Manuka. This is the first class in a series given by Brother Adam Burns on the subject, Learning to Lean. This class is titled, Belonging.
Good morning. I love that about North America. When you listen to MP3s about old tapes from Bible schools, you guys are very good on the good morning, so that's lovely. The other thing about North America, you're good on the amens, and I love that. I love that at the end of a prayer, so be it. You are involved in that prayer. It's a lovely thing about the American ecclesias or the North American ecclesias. So at the very beginning of this series on Jacob, I'd like to give away the end at the beginning. I don't know about you, but I like hands, and it's not just because we've got opposable thumbs. I like them because I think they're an evocative image. When you think about a baby, and that image there in the top right-hand corner, it's a lovely image. If you're a little bit squeamish, I'm sorry, but that's an image of an operation on a womb. And during that operation, the baby's hand has come out and clung on to the nurse or the doctor's finger. It's a lovely, lovely image. If you type it into Google, you'll see there's a few images like that. And I love that about babies' hands. They're not just soft and squidgy and lovely, but they're kind of expressive, aren't they? They're expressive of innocence. They're expressive of potential. That's a lovely thing about hands. And similarly, when we come to an older person's hands, they are equally an evocative image. They're expressive of experience. Every line, wrinkle and scar. If you're an old person, you might not think that. But when I look at your hands, you might think, oh, well, look at that. I'm slowly dying like everyone else. But when I look at your hands, and I can see, I'm 40, I'm starting to see that my hands are starting to get a little bit looser, and I can see that age is catching up on me also. But when I look at old people's hands, they're expressive of experience and wisdom, the ups and downs of life. Sometimes they've been held in clenched fists of anguish, pain, and all the terrible things that can happen in our lives. Other times in thankfulness and praise and prayer, they're expressive and an evocative image, our hands. And so when we come to Jacob, I'd like to give you what I think is the key idea when it comes to Jacob. In fact, I think the scriptures are at pains to demonstrate this when it comes to him. Everyone hold up your hands. I'm not going to get all Pentecostal on you. It's okay. Okay, give me some magic fingers. That'll be lovely. Okay, thank you. That, biblically, is the image, thank you, of Jacob. I'm going to try and pick up on that and just see that there's this thread when it comes to Jacob's life that is all about his hands. So if you like imagery, if you like symbols or signature features in the Bible, then for Jacob, it's his hands. And I think if you tune in to the hands, you tune in to Jacob. If the Bible was on video, what would be the first thing you would see of Jacob in Genesis chapter 25? If you're watching the video of Jacob's life, first thing you'd see of him is his hands. It's the very first thing we see of Jacob. What's the final thing? In Hebrews chapter 11, the final thing that Hebrews chapter 11 picks up on, you go to Hebrews and you think, oh, I want to find out what's this faithful thing about Jacob. I can see it about Abraham. It's his journey. I can see it about Moses. He chose not to associate with Pharaoh's court. What is it about Jacob? And you go there, and in a sense, it's almost a disappointing read. It's a little bit odd. It says, by faith, he leant upon his staff, worshipping God with a bowed head, and blessed his two grandsons. You think, well, that's not so special, is it? Don't most grandparents bless their grandchildren? But if that was a movie, show me what that would look like when he blessed. That's it, Eric. Come on, do it loud and proud. That's it. Do you remember that? Remember that? The blessing, because, of course, Joseph brought the eldest towards his right, and the youngest towards his right hand, and the youngest towards his left hand. Of course, you remember, if we saw that in a movie, again, you would see his hands. And again, right at the very end, Hebrews 11 picks up on that imagery. leaning on a staff. There's his hands wrapped around that staff and blessing his grandchildren. So beginning to end, that's the image. And I want you to think about Jacob's life. Just think about the hands wrestling an angel covered in goat's hair, making altars, cooking the stew to take the birthright, breaking sticks and strips to do that weird thing that he does with the breeding of the animals. And so his hands are really an evocative image and one worth being, I guess, cognizant of throughout this week. But for this session today, this morning, we're actually going to focus on another image to capture our attention. And Moses is a wonderful writer. If we accept that Moses wrote Genesis and Exodus, a number of books, then he is a wonderful writer. His imagery and his symbology are rich. And the scripture, that the passages that he has written are full of images. Fruitfulness, of course, that's one image that starts with Moses' writings and run all the way through. We saw already East and West starts with Moses' writing. It's a scriptural theme. Two seeds, enmity, the sort of polarisation of with God and against God. All these ideas commence with Moses' writing style. And when he writes Genesis, I think he intentionally focuses on key symbols or images. No surprise, is it? It's a great way to remember scripture, to pick up on these images and symbols. And Jacob has his own particular ones. Hands are one, but there is another. So let's start and pick up on this second image in today's class in Genesis chapter 25. We're going to start with the beginning of Jacob's life and we'll read together verses 19 to 23. These are the generations of Isaac, Abraham's sons. Abraham fathered Isaac, and Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah, the daughter of Bethuel, the Aramean of Padan Aram, the sister of Laban the Aramean, to be his wife. And Isaac prayed to the Lord for his wife because she was barren, and the Lord granted his prayer, and Rebekah his wife conceived. The children struggled together within her, and she said, "If it is thus, why is this happening to me?" So she went to inquire of the Lord, and the Lord said to her, "Two nations are in your womb, and two peoples from within you shall be divided. The one shall be stronger and the other stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger." When her days to give birth were completed, behold, there were twins in her womb. The first came out red, all his body like a hairy cloak, so they called his name Esau. Afterward, his brother came out with his hands holding Esau's heel, so his name was called Jacob. Isaac was 60 years old when she bore them. And so, like her mother-in-law, Sarah, Rebecca also has some problems conceiving. Remember, she's 60 years of age now, and God responds, and Rebecca conceives. And this is no ordinary pregnancy. I mean, people have been having babies for a long time by now, so there's nothing naive about her response. There's no ordinary pregnancy for her. And so she goes to inquire of the Lord. An interesting thing, I'm not quite sure what that means, whether there was a place or an altar, or whether it was to Melchizedek. I'm not quite sure what that means, to inquire of the Lord. And assuming there was no intercessor, that this is, I think, the second occasion where God speaks directly to a woman, Eve being the first. And it's a prophecy. And I think it's quite an unusual answer. She asks about her child. She says, "I've got this problem with my pregnancy. There's all this agitation within me." And she gets an answer about much more than that. And if I was to paraphrase it, the answer is, we are having twins. They're going to be not just two boys, they're going to be the forefathers of two nations. Sorry about this, but they're going to be engaged in ongoing contention and conflict. These two boys, two nations, contention. And this is going to be relevant to you, Rebecca, because it's going to start with the two boys as they break out, and that's the Hebrew, as they break out of your womb, the contention will start immediately. Now, what an odd answer for this woman. A little more than what she probably anticipated. A difficult pregnancy is one thing, but then in the middle of having to deal with this, in the middle of that difficult pregnancy, having to deal with this promise of impending family conflict, of families becoming two nations, and it happening the moment the boys are born, this thing will start. And no doubt a difficult time for Rebecca. But then, of course, we're introduced to them, and we read, we might just read on verses 26 to 28. Did we get there? 27 and 28. We're introduced to the boys. When the boys grew up, Esau was a skillful hunter, a man of the field, while Jacob was a quiet man, dwelling in tents. Isaac loved Esau because he ate of his game, but Rebekah loved Jacob. And so the prophecy to Rebekah is dramatically true. The boys struggled in the womb. The boys are going to struggle throughout their lives. But who would have expected as they came out of the womb in verse 26, who would have expected them to come literally out of the womb with Jacob struggling with Esau, holding on to his brother's heel? And so everything about this incident is unusual. Bad pregnancy, incredible prophecy, the circumstances of the birth are unusual. You've got this swift birth with, you know, one baby literally straight after the other. They're wrestling, and then, of course, even the actual look of one of the children. And so, as far as I'm aware, the scripture is not the Guinness Book of Records of unusual births. Like, that's not what... When Moses sat down, I think I'm going to write up the most unusual births of history. I don't think that was the point of recording this. There's an intentional message here, of course. And I think the message, first of all, is to note the hands. They're a symbol of that contention. They're a symbol of the man, Jacob himself. They're even a symbol of the nation. When we think about this nation of Israel today, this idea of contention and struggling and wrestling with God, symbol of the man, symbol of the nation, and I don't know about you, but they certainly symbolise my own journey in Christ. That it seems to be this kind of contention, this wrestling in my own with my will versus God's will, and this hands-on issue. And so, in verses 27 and 28, we move from symbol to prophecy. We move from prophecy, from imagery, to get our first statement about these men. And they're just two very simple statements, really, about each man. First, Esau, well, he's a skillful hunter. He's a man of the field, statement of fact. And the second is about Jacob. He's a quiet or a plain man, and he lives in a tent. Now, if that's all you knew about these two men, I'd be interested in what the sisters think. If you've put out of your mind anything else that you know about those two men, one's a hunter, a man of the field, one's a plain man living in a tent, who's more naturally drawn to Esau, sisters only?
Yeah.
He's not home all the time. That's handy, isn't it? Yeah, that's very good. He's not a mummy's boy. He's a hunter. He's a kind of a man's man. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So some sisters will be more attracted to that kind of guy. And who's more attracted to a plain man, a quiet man, at home in a tent? There's a few. Yeah, that's right. Oh, and really, really, in many ways, if we divorce from our minds or everything else we know about them, they're two simple statements. In many ways, they're kind of neutral statements. One's outdoorsy, the other's not. A statement of fact. And when you read the commentators and you hear what other people have to say about it, about these two kind of character descriptions or these two statements about these two men, they say, well, I think what we're getting at here is roles within the family. That's what they believe that Moses is identifying when he writes this. That Esau, for this collection, this family, this band of people, Esau, he's a provider of food. And Jacob, he's kind of at home in the tent as an administrator. And of course, we know from Hebrews that at one stage, Abraham, Isaac and Jacob and all that were with them, they at one stage all lived together. And so both those tasks were critical. Someone provided the food, someone was the administrator of that great band of people. But I suspect that there's much more being said here than what we might first appreciate. There's something a little odd about those two statements, something we should just, I guess, have a bit of a think about. The description has an odd reference within it. Something's not quite right, or at least unusually stated. So I want you to have a think about those two statements. One's a hunter, the other's a quiet man who lives in a tent. What's, if you're a journalist, you're kind of thinking about this, trying to analyse those words, what's a bit odd about those statements? Can anyone got any ideas? Something that's kind of like, so what? What's significant, or insignificant in fact, about Jacob living in a tent? Yeah, that's a very good point. So at this stage, as in a sense blank canvases, we've just been introduced to them. We're not given any insight into their relationship with God, so that's a good point. But it's wrong. It's not what I was thinking of. No, it's not wrong. It's not wrong. It's a very good point. But did you?
One is a people person, and the other one's a nature person.
That's true. So one seems to be involved with people, the other one's with nature. I guess the point I was trying to. They all lived in tents. So what? So what that Jacob, it says here, lives in a tent? Esau lived in a tent. Isaac lived in a tent. It says later on in Genesis that Rachel goes home to her tent. So why would you pick out this kind of thing? It's like, you know, wow, Wendy breathes air. It's like, no, sorry. We all breathe air. It's like, what's the point that's being made? Why single out living in a tent? And I think to try and understand what the author is getting at here, we need to understand the book that the author is writing. Is there a message here to try and tune into, a theme or an idea? And I suspect you know where I'm going to go with this, at least I hope you do, but I just want to consider, when Moses wrote this book, the immediate context around this idea of where one lives or where one dwells, because there is a thread or a theme that I think we just need to step back and pick up on in Moses' writing. And so what I want to do is just look at these five passages and just get a bit of an idea, because most sit, there's two before, two after, and one in the chapter that we've just looked at. So in Genesis chapter 11, and we mentioned this briefly last night, it says verses 4 to 5, then they said, come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its tops in the heavens, and let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be dispersed over the face of the whole earth. And the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the children of man had built. So up until this stage, I guess people were mostly nomadic, mostly Bedouins. There's nothing up under Genesis chapter 11 about cities or towers. And was that a good decision or a bad decision? Yeah. So we know what's happening when it comes to cities and towers, at least when it comes to Genesis chapter 11. The cities are associated with self-importance. Okay, so Moses is writing this book. Let's see if there's a theme emerging here. So in Genesis 13, of course, there's another association with a city. And Lot, in Genesis 13, verses 10 to 12, lifted up his eyes and beheld all the plain of Jordan, that it was well watered everywhere, before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, even as the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt, as thou comest unto Zoar. Then Lot chose him all the plain of Jordan, and Lot journeyed east, and they separated themselves one from the other. Abram dwelled in the land of Canaan, and Lot dwelled in the cities of the plain, and pitched his tent towards Sodom. And we understand this kind of evolution that Lot went through, because he ends up, where does he end up? Not with his tent, sitting in the gate of the city. That's right. So there's this progressive sort of movement of Lot eastward to the point where he's within the city itself. And of course, the city of Sodom is associated with a godless environment that was ultimately destroyed. In Genesis chapter 25, of course, this is the very chapter where it says, oh, and just note this, that Jacob lives in a tent. Before we get to that part of the chapter, there's some commentary about not Isaac and Jacob's line, but the other line, about Ishmael and his sons. And it's interesting because you're actually getting a bit of a juxtaposition within chapter 25 of Jacob, who lives in a tent, and Ishmael and his boys, who, and we might just pick it up midway through from Genesis 25, verse 7 to 18, we might pick it up just here. Now, these are the generations of Ishmael, Abraham's sons, whom Hagar the Egyptian, Sarah's handmaid, bare unto Abraham. These are the names of the sons of Ishmael by their names according to their generations. The names are all listed. These are the sons of Ishmael, and these are their names by their towns, by their castles, 12 princes according to their nations. Once again, I think it's pretty hard to miss. I think you've got this idea that Ishmael, not the line, Isaac being the other line, Isaac, Jacob and the boys, Ishmael and his boys, well, their association, the way in which they represent themselves is kind of this arrogant way, and they're associated with towns, castles, and building of themselves nations. Genesis chapter 34. We again briefly considered this last night when Jacob comes and camps outside the city of Shechem, and he's before the, or in the face of the city. He buys some land there. He associates with that city, mixes with that city, and of course we know the outcome is a disaster. And then finally, if there's Jacob, if we pick up on Jacob, and he says he lives in a tent, well, what about Esau and his boys? And again, we're coming now after this chapter, in Genesis chapter 36, verses 40 to 43. And these are the names of the dukes, the chiefs, that came out of Esau, according to their families, after their places, by their names, Chief Timnah, Chief Alva, Chief Japheth, Chief Aholibamah, Chief Elah, Chief Pinon, Chief Kenaz, Chief Teman, Chief Mibzah, Chief Magdiel, Chief Iram. These be the chiefs of Edom according to their habitations in the land of their possession. He is Esau, the father of the Edomites. And again, this idea of them being chiefs or princes, names of places and people, leap off the page. And so when we come to this context, both just before and just after Jacob's birth, I think it's fair to say that when it comes to that cities and towns have an association with those things that are base, with those things that are immoral, with those things that are human. And Moses, of course, is just developing a theme. He's pointing out a truism for the time. Now, this discussion about that there's this distinction between city life and living in a tent would be totally tenuous if it wasn't for one other quote, a New Testament quote. And that quote is Hebrews 11. Hebrews 11, verses 8 to 10. By faith, Abraham, when he was called to go out into a place which he should afterward receive for an inheritance, obeyed. And he went out, not knowing whither he went. By faith, he sojourned in the land of promise, as in a strange country, dwelling in tabernacles with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. For he looked for a city which hath foundations, whose builder and maker is God. Now, I've always read, I guess, this piece of scripture singularly about Abraham. This must be only talking about Abraham, and that Isaac and Jacob were kind of bystanders, like the kids in tow in this decision of Abraham's. But I really like, when you have a bit of a think about these words here, heirs with him, the word means participant. The words mean participant in common. So Isaac and Jacob had to sign on to this idea that, okay, Abraham, that's fine, you're a better one, that's great, Dad. Ishmael didn't pick up on that idea at all. It took Isaac and Jacob to say, no, we're participants in common with this idea. We're going to sign on to that idea. And so this is the point. There is an attitude about this family. There's this family creed, an agreement within the family, and it's this. It's God's leading us. Some better place is coming from God, and that we belong with God and his place. That's the attitude that Moses is trying to record. Abraham was the first to adopt this kind of family creed, and he remained faithful to it. Isaac, he adopts it. He agreed, okay, I'm not going to have any abiding place. I'm going to trust in God and his promises. God said, I'm going to trust in that. He's going to deliver. Ishmael and his sons, so they didn't accept that. They weren't participants in common. They didn't adopt it. Jacob did. Jacob lived in a tent. He respected and he sought God's leadership and tuned in and was a participant in common with the family's creed. Yeah, it's true. Esau was a skillful hunter. But let me tell you something extra about Jacob. He was a complete man and he lived in a tent. A lot more than a job description, a lot more than a boy who just wants to be with his mum. I've read commentators say that. This is just, he was a bit of a mummy's boy living at home in the tent with his mum. That's a lot more than that. This is an introduction to the person. This is Moses providing us with a summation of that person. It's code. It's code for what makes him tick on the inside. It's code for character. And so for me, I think this idea, this imagery, so we talked about the imagery that started with hands, but this idea of living in a tent, this bit of imagery is one that I think deserves at least my continual referencing, my pondering, just musing on this idea and returning to it over and over in my life as a disciple. Is this image still important in my life? Where is it that I belong? Is my creed, do I have, is that code, this idea of living in a tent, is that relevant to me? Because I don't know about you, but I find just kind of living as a disciple really clunky and awkward in terms of how I relate to the world around me. And I'm sure I'm not alone in this. This is just such a difficult way to sort of have this idea that, yes, I'm waiting for God. I trust in his promises. I'm trying to be this person that, in code, lives in a tent, and yet I find it such a great struggle to just work out how that kind of, what's the nexus or what's the distinction? How do I work with the people around me and the world around me? How do I sort of segment those lives seamlessly? And so I think we should be asking ourselves, where is it that I feel as though I belong the most? I mean, where is it? Where do I actually feel at home and comfortable day to day in my life? Is this where I want to be? Is this my favourite place? Is Manuka the thing that I like to be? Or do I prefer to be at the office? Do I actually feel like that's my place? When am I most comfortable? Is it important that I belong to a community? I kind of think about this. If that's that family had that kind of attitude, they had their own sort of little community happening, is it important that I belong to this community? And is living in a tent a helpful symbol for me to think about that? And so for me, it's kind of my chief filter when it comes to how I associate with the people and the places around me, how I try to live as a disciple. So I know as a community, we've kind of got almost these mini rules historically around things like voting and jury duty and those kind of things. But to me, I'm not really interested in those mini rules. I'm interested in this symbol. This symbol about, well, hang on, what does it mean for me to live in a tent? To me, that's the filter that I use for all those matters of conscience. Where do I belong? In the tent or elsewhere? that make sense? Does that resonate with people? Okay, so we'll conclude shortly, but I think it's important to not be too one-eyed. Did you get that? When it comes to Jacob, did you get that? Yes. To not be too one-eyed when it comes to Jacob. Because there is that other insight that Moses provides. He says, yes, let me tell you about this boy. He chose to live in a tent, but he also tells us about the unusual circumstance of his birth. He is born holding Esau's heel. As we said, this isn't just hot gossip. This isn't just a freakish incident to record. This is a reference equally full of meaning. I mean, we're quick to ascribe meaning to Esau being a hunter and a man of the field. We're quick to sort of, that's what that guy's like. Yeah, no good. So we're quick to sort of give meaning to that. We should be equally quick to give meaning to the other character descriptions and the other visual descriptions of Jacob. And again, it's all about the hands. Each feature of Moses' record of their birth and their character descriptions is vital in coming to understand what he's like. And so, like me, his character is split in many ways. In many ways, like me, he's kind of torn with his discipleships. His personality is often a contradiction. His actions often diametrically opposed, even within minutes. 1 minute, Jacob could be doing something wonderful, and a few minutes later, something incredibly... You think, how did you get from there to there? And this is the struggle, this is the wrestle when it comes to Jacob. So we can't be too one-eyed about him, because he's probably... And he is, just like you and I. He's struggling with his discipleship. And so finally, have you ever thought what will be written on your gravestone? Has anyone written that down yet? To give to their partner or loved one? No? My favourite, of course, is Spike Milligan's. Can you recall what he said? That's right, I told you I was sick. Yeah. That's a good one. And I guess with a gravestone, how can you take a life, and reduce it down to even the eulogy at a funeral? How do you take a whole life and reduce it down to sort of 10 to 20 minutes? It's a cruel thing to do, isn't it? Just to take a life and reduce it to 10 to 20 minutes. Then you've got to take that life and reduce it to just a few words on a gravestone. That is a very difficult thing to do. Well, for today, there is a statement that I think deserves thinking about. Because for today, we've been introduced to a man whose life has been compressed into just a few words. We've barely been introduced to him. We've been told so little already. We've been told, okay, he wrestled in a womb. We've told he's going to struggle with his brother through his life. We've been told he was born holding a heel. And yet we've really been told everything important already. We've been given his gravestone summation. He's a complete man. And he lived in a tent. So what of you then? What would be the short sentence that Moses might ascribe to your life? Do you live in a tent? Are you a participant in common with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob? Have you got the family attitude? Is that what makes you tick? Are you passionate about that above everything else in your life? The great thing about a gravestone statement is that it sums up the overall character. But I think the veracity of this positive statement is untested for us yet. And hopefully, by the end of this week, you will be happily able to, and I think meaningfully able to, sum up Jacob the very same way that Moses does when he says, yeah, this is Jacob, a complete man living in a tent.
Thank you.